from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Get out of here, you low-life scum.
That was U.S. Senator John McCain Thursday at a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee as it prepared to take testimony from former Nixon administration Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. McCain was responding to protesters from the group Code Pink who were chanting demands for Kissinger to be tried for war crimes for his role in both the Vietnam War and the 1973 U.S. orchestrated coup in Chile.
Arrest Henry Kissinger for war crimes!
Could I,
arrest Henry Kissinger for war crimes!
Could I ask our Capitol Police to help restore order here?
The third summit of the heads of state of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, or CELAC, wrapped up Thursday after a two-day session with calls to maintain unity and promote integration, statements of support of Venezuela and Cuba, and a plan to eradicate poverty, hunger, and inequality in the region over the next 10 years. The conference closed with agreement on a number of key points, including a regional commitment to eradicate hunger by 2025, a call for an end to U.S. meddling in member countries, an end to the U.S. blockade against Cuba, and a call for Puerto Rico to be included in future CELAC meetings. Regional leaders also approved 27 special declarations covering a wide range of topics affecting the region, including a call to erect a permanent monument to honor the victims of the transatlantic slave trade. The group also approved resolutions backing Argentina's claim to the Malvinas and supporting the peace process in Colombia. The special declarations also called for a new international financial structure, financing for development projects, and demanded action on climate change. At the conference, Cuba's President Raul Castro said that the restoration of diplomatic relations with the U.S. is the beginning of a process towards normalization, but that this would not be possible if the blockade still exists, if the territory of Guantanamo, which he said was illegally occupied by the U.S. Navy, isn't returned, if the radio and TV broadcasts from the United States, which violate international norms, do not cease, and if the Cuban people are not fairly compensated for the human and economic damage they endured as a consequence of U.S. sanctions. Estimates of the cost of the U.S. sanctions over the past 50 years to the Cuban economy exceed $1 trillion. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest responded by pointing to the Cuban president's remarks as an example of the, quote, wide variety of disagreements between the U.S. and Cuba, closed quote. He said there was a clear difference between reestablishing diplomatic relations and carrying out the longer process of normalizing relations. We'll have more on the CELAC conference when we speak with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, later in this newscast. The new left-wing Greek government has said that it will not cooperate with the troika of international lenders and does not plan to seek an extension for its aid package, set to expire at the end of February. Without the aid, Greek banks could face a shutoff from the European Central Bank. Speaking at a joint press conference with the head of the Eurozone Finance Ministers Group, Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis said Greece will not cooperate with the so-called Troika, which consists of the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the IMF, but only with the governments of the EU. We have this report from RT's Murad Gazdiev.
You know, I'd say we aren't seeing the start of a standoff. We're in the midst of one. Greece is now cutting its ties with the Troika. And during a meeting between the Greek finance minister and the chief of the Eurozone's finance ministers group, and that meeting apparently was very, very tense, leaving the Troika representative, according to journalists who were there, visibly enraged. During that meeting, the Greek finance minister said that this is it, that they no longer need the bailout program, that they're not going to extend it. It's no longer needed, he said, that after it expires next month, Greece will be off of it. But he justified his decision, saying that this is what they promised the Greek people who voted for them, that this is what they see as the future of Greece. But it's worth noting that this isn't all they promised, the end of austerity. They also promised to have half the debt of Greece, half of the 240 billion euros provided to them, written off. And that has set alarm bells ringing in Europe. Europe is very much against this. We've heard the German finance ministry, various heads of states and finance ministers say that this is divorced from reality, that Greece is not going to get its way. But you know, it really looks like Greece is set on action. They've been dropping bombshell after bombshell over the last few days. So it looks like there's a much grander showdown still ahead.
Greece may have another source of funding available if it breaks with the Troika, Russia. Although Greece reportedly hasn't asked Russia for a loan outright, Russian Finance Minister Anton Siluanov said in an interview with CNBC in Moscow Thursday that Moscow would definitely consider it. His statement came a day after Greece openly opposed further economic sanctions against Russia at the EU. Russia gave Greece a very valuable card to play in its negotiations when it announced that the South Stream pipeline would be rerouted through Turkey, with a gas hub expected to be built on the border between Turkey and Greece. And it's not only Greece which is challenging the EU. Spain is echoing Athens' example with the rapid rise of a left-wing party. It's called Podemos, which means we can. Lola Sanchez, a member of the European Parliament for Spain's Podemos party, which is widely predicted to follow Greece's example, says that Brussels has no choice but to listen to Athens. She spoke with RT's Kevin Owen Friday.
Why your surge in popularity? Well, according to this latest poll anyway, why are you so popular right now, do you think, in hitting the right note with so many people?
Well, I think that mainly because we think things of common sense. I mean, we don't talk about utopic things. We are just thinking and saying the people that we want to defend the people, that it's very common sense. It's only that. It's what's happening in Greece.
The killing continues in the eastern part of Ukraine, with dozens more civilian casualties reported in Donetsk after artillery attacks by Ukrainian troops. We begin with this report from Press TV.
The escalating violence in Ukraine's Rostov East over the past 24 hours have left at least two dozen people dead. Ukrainian officials said 19 civilians were among the dead in the clashes between government forces and pro-Russia militias. Kiev says some 23 people were also wounded in shelling across the industrial province of Donetsk. This comes as some 45 others lost their lives in the past week's shelling of residential areas in Ukraine's volatile east. Pro-Russia militias blamed the attacks on government forces.
Meanwhile, a United Nations official in the country called for an immediate humanitarian truce in the eastern part of the country. Heavy fighting has intensified in the densely populated areas of the east in recent days. Delivery of medical aid to the affected populations has been increasingly difficult. Daniel Dickinson reports from the United Nations.
The UN humanitarian coordinator in Ukraine has expressed alarm over the deterioration of the situation in the two key towns of Donetsk and Oblast. The violence between government and pro-secession opposition forces has also made it hard for people to find safety or leave the war-torn areas. Stefan Dujarric, the UN spokesperson, has more.
Mia Walker, the humanitarian coordinator in Ukraine, is calling for an immediate humanitarian truce to allow civilians to leave if they want to, and for aid workers to assist affected communities and to allow for the safe evacuation of the injured and peaceful civilian population. He said that unfortunately we continue to receive credible reports indicating that military positions are dangerously close to densely populated areas and places such as hospitals, schools, orphanages, and homes for the elderly.
The UN says that indiscriminate shelling of civilians violates international humanitarian law and has to stop. The Ukrainian political crisis that began in 2014 has transcended into violent clashes in parts of the country, later reaching full-scale conflict in the east. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Fighting in Ukraine has caused more than 5,000 casualties since it began last year, with the vast majority of the deaths being of civilians killed by rocket and artillery fire from the Ukrainian military on the densely populated cities of Donetsk and Lugansk. Also at the UN, the Security Council met Wednesday to discuss the situation in Syria. Council members heard a terse statement from Syria's permanent representative over the council's failure to stop the flow of weapons and support of anti-government fighters into the country through Turkey and other neighboring nations. Syria's ambassador, Bashar Ja'afari, named U.S. ally Saudi Arabia as one country providing material aid to the terrorist group al-Nusra Front, and said there were other countries involved in the training and arming of terrorists to fight in his country, a clear reference to the U.S. backing of anti-government forces there. This week's CELAC conference closed after some major actions were taken by the group, including the seating of a representative of an independent Puerto Rico by Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega, and a demand by Havana for reparations for the half-century of sanctions imposed on the country by the U.S. For that and more, we now go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Okay, busy week. Let's get started.
Yeah, last week we didn't give people a heads up that on the 28th and the 29th of January they held the summit of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. And that was of huge importance, obviously, for the region, because it's defining various strategic points of view and patterns of behavior and not necessarily extremely precise policy, but certainly policy priorities, for example. And there's a general consensus throughout the region that they must continue to prioritize poverty reduction and the reduction of inequality, because Latin America remains one of the most unequal, if not the most unequal, set of societies in the world. Mm-hmm. And also all the more routine stuff about development cooperation and technological cooperation, that kind of thing. But the important thing is that they're prioritizing the reduction of poverty, and that's not just rhetoric, because they've made huge progress in that area over the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Yeah, they've been doing it. That's right, and they're saying we're staying committed to this and we're moving forward. They also expressed again a strong statement of their intent to protect their sovereignty and to pursue regional integration further. Which
both. President Nicolas Maduro, President Daniel Ortega, and President Evo Morales in particular, were in terms of the normal protocols of the and culture of these high-level summits, they were extremely outspoken against the interference of the United States, in particular against Venezuela, while at the same time as they were very welcoming and complimentary to the government of President Obama for its decision to open up relations with Cuba. Mm. You probably read President Raul Castro's speech more closely than I did, Don, but the gist of it seems to have been that while welcoming the normalization or the moves towards the normalization of its diplomatic and economic and political relations with the United States, the Cuban government is also insisting that those moves don't make any sense unless they ultimately lead to an end to the economic blockade and the financial persecution, the economic persecution of Cuban interests around the world, and the interests of companies that and not just private businesses, but also governments that may have interactions with Cuba. So, and that was a very strong. And I think you said in a text message that you sent me that I'd missed this in his speech, that Raul Castro also mentioned the issue of reparations to Cuba for the costs of the blockade, which are run into tens of billions of dollars.
Trillions. I think the estimate I saw last year was $1.1 trillion or something. I almost chuckled. You know, it was 50 years. It's a long time. So, and also that the U.S. should give back the Cuban territory it occupies to operate the torture chamber in Guantanamo. Yeah.
Right.
So, that's interesting. I just want to say what's interesting to me is this summit took place almost in the shadow of Syriza's win in Greece and the recent headbanging sessions that they've had over both the characterization of what Russia is doing in Ukraine, and an assertion of the sovereignty of Greece as against the EU and international finance institutions. And then I saw this morning, actually, which is, you know, we could kick this around later. Russia apparently was asked, would you guys bail out Greece if they don't reach a deal by February 28th? And they were like, we won't rule that out. You know, we're going to look at the whole picture, but we ain't ruling that out.
Right. And you see I know that's a whole other discussion, isn't it? But yeah, it does come back to this issue of relatively small, vulnerable, economically vulnerable countries being subject to gross intimidation and pressure by wealthier countries like the United States and its NATO allies, Canada, and the countries of the European Union. And it's precisely that the community of Latin American and Caribbean states is essentially working to overcome.
Right.
And with much success, it has to be said,
that's
because
right.
And one of the interesting, there are all kinds of interesting little footnotes to the overall event, but it may be worth pointing out yet again that the fundamental meaning and significance of the very existence of the community of Latin American and Caribbean states is that it's put a decisive end to European, to the predominance at least, of European and North American influence and power and prestige and control in Latin America, and perhaps to a lesser extent in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. But it can't be stated too much that the fundamental strength of the CELAC mechanism is that all the countries involved agree to respect each other's differences and to forge unity out of political diversity. And you don't see that, for example, in the European Union. In the European Union, what you've got is a monolithic neoliberal economic political construct. And if a country like Greece doesn't toe the line, it gets hammered.
Mm.
And that's not what's happening in Latin America and the Caribbean. What's happening in Latin America and the Caribbean is that countries come together, compare notes, agree to disagree, and on areas of agreement, collaborate and cooperate closely.
Right.
You know, and that's a very, very, and it's very, and I think that they've been strongly influenced by the thinking of China and also the thinking of Russia, because, and what they're doing in practice is putting into practice how a multipolar world should work.
Right. That's
and
right.
They're making it work. And I think that's the fundamental importance of CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. What's your take?
I think that this thing that is essentially maybe the grand brainchild of Hugo Chavez that's come into just almost a level of maturity. Is an example to many other places around the world. And in Europe, that monolithic block has a crack in it now with Syriza's name on it. And,
right.
The model that's been pursued in Central South America, Caribbean, offers benefits to South Europe for sure as an alternative to what they're going through. And the people on the ground, I had a conversation Tuesday, I think, with George Katrugalos, who's a member of the European Parliament from Syriza. And they're going to play hardball up there, and we're starting to see it. And he said that Podemos in Spain?
Podemos
in Spain, yeah, is... They are poised to do very well in the elections later on this year in Spain, and Italy, Portugal, some of the Balkans, even France, the people are looking to that model of dealing with it to see if it has anything to offer them. And the, you know, the logical conclusion of that is a realignment of Europe that looks more like the CELAC organization and the others, ALBA and other organizations in that region.
Yeah, it remains to be seen whether the European elites will ever let that happen.
Oh,
I was very disappointed to see that Syriza had had signed up for the declaration against Russia of the European Union.
Well, that actually that hasn't been reported properly, because actually what was signed on to was amended. It removed the condemnation of Russia or implication of Russia in the bombing of Mariupol. Even the OSCE says nothing in terms of evidence about, and also delayed consideration of new sanctions until late in February. That's
okay,
what they signed on to.
Let's see how that all pans out. And in relation to the situation in Latin America and the Caribbean, one has to bear in mind that it's not that there aren't differences, and I found it quite dramatic, actually, and I don't know what other observers made of it, but I found it quite dramatic that Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua gave way. He shared his space with Ruben Berrios of the Puerto Rican sovereignty movement.
Wow.
And he gave his chair to Puerto Rico so that Puerto Rico could directly address the heads of state of Latin America and the Caribbean.
Wow.
And that is a first. President Solis of Costa Rica, with whom that Nicaragua doesn't have very good relations at the moment with Costa Rica,
and
in bilateral terms, because they have this dispute over the Rio San Juan, among other issues.
Right.
But Solis tried to suggest that this was a breach of protocol, and Daniel Ortega was really insistent and emphatic in defending his right, his sovereign right as Nicaragua, to give this space to what should be a fellow member on equal terms.
That's right.
Of Latin America and the Caribbean, which is Puerto Rico.
Right.
And that was reflected in the positions of Venezuela and Cuba and Bolivia. And I think it was that insistence of the ALBA bloc of countries that forced the inclusion of a call by CELAC for the decolonization of Puerto Rico in their final declaration.
Whoa, they did? They did that? Wow.
And I think that's part of the final declaration. I might be wrong about that, because I've been looking like crazy on the web for the text of the final declaration, which has something like 93 paragraphs and 22 associated declarations. But one of those declarations is support for the decolonization of Puerto Rico.
Wow, that's fantastic. I haven't seen it yet. I was going to look at that stuff later.
Yeah, and it was, and here in Nicaragua, it was very, very strongly covered, because it was one of the main, it was the main initiative of the Nicaraguan government in terms of that particular summit. And what the other thing that various speakers at the summit referred to was the upcoming summit of the Americas that will include Canada and the United States, which will be held in Panama under President Varela. And I'm not sure when it is. I think it's in March. I might be wrong about that. Anyway, and they all referred to the fact that this will be the first summit of the Americas in which Cuba will have been present.
Mm, interesting.
And that's something to, that'll be an interesting event to cover, and the different wrinkles that will come out of that.
There's a whole different, whole different world at those summits now, because you have seated within the body, within the whole. You have CELAC, you have the ALBA countries, you have these new modes of regional integration that, you know, now we're all going to this meeting with the Americans and Canadians, basically. And it's a whole different relationship than existed prior to the existence of these other organizations.
Yeah, because the organization of American states was always dominated by, or until the foundation of organizations like the Union of South American States, UNISOR, ALBA, to some extent the system of Central American integration, SICA, Mercosur, all these organizations. And the organization of American states was always dominated by the agenda of the United States and its NATO ally Canada. And that's, you know, those days are gone. I'm gone for good, by the looks of things.
Right. Yeah, you used to have essentially, when they had those meetings, the South American elites were negotiating their pay with the United States, basically.
Yeah, right. So then, the other things, and lots of little things that are kind of details in terms of the summit, but have tremendous significance in regional terms. For example, there was a meeting. I understand there was a meeting between Evo Morales and Michelle Bachelet in the context of the summit, and that will have been extremely important in terms of Bolivia's historic claim to territory permitting it to have an outlet to the Pacific Ocean, because Bolivia's completely landlocked as a result of essentially colonial disputes. That ended up in wars back in the 19th century, fomented by mainly by the European powers in that case.
Right.
And so, and also the Malvinas again figured in the agenda of CELAC. They again stated their support for a solution to British colonization of the Malvinas in favor of Argentina.
Right.
There was that. There was support for Venezuela in its position demanding that the United States stop interfering in it.
Oh,
yes. Yeah. There was a whole series of statements like that coming out from CELAC that reflect the way that even right-wing governments are committed to promoting the integration and promoting the autonomy and independence of the region, and that you would have been unthinkable even just 5-6 years ago.
Right.
You know?
Right. If you go back 13 years, you had Cuba and Venezuela, essentially, and coup in Venezuela.
Right.
You know, and now look where we are.
Yeah, and There are all kinds of things to be concerned about. For example, the situation in Haiti is extremely disturbing, and I didn't see that being dealt with in the context of the summit. But that may have to do with the fact that one of the fundamental principles of CELAC is non-interference in the internal affairs of the member governments. So, for example, and that was one of the things that was interesting in the way Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela related to President Juan Manuel Santos of Colombia, because all the CELAC states support the peace process in Cuba. But nobody, as far as I'm aware, even hinted at criticizing the Colombian government for what seems to be its military policy that is putting that peace process in danger, because whereas the FARC guerrillas have declared a unilateral ceasefire, in fact the military are taking advantage of that ceasefire to step up their military operations of aggression against the FARC positions in the areas where the FARC is active in Colombia. So it was interesting that as an issue didn't actually come up. What did come up was the issue of, and it was mentioned by Nicolas Maduro, was the issue of the way right-wing politicians are directly intervening and interfering in the internal affairs of Venezuela. And he was referring to a proposed visit by former President of Colombia Andrés Pastrana, former President of Chile Sebastián Piñera, and former President of Mexico Felipe Calderón, that was proposed that they go to Venezuela to meet with Leopoldo López, who's the one of the main leaders of the Venezuelan opposition.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.